Welcome to Attack the System. I'm your host, Keith Preston, here on Countercurrents. With me tonight is Craig Fitzgerald, who is returning to the program. He previously came on when I was still on VOR doing this, and Craig is back again tonight. Craig, welcome.
Oh, thank you, Keith. Thanks for having me again. It's an honor to be on the show once again.
For those who haven't heard the other interview that I did with Craig, Craig is one of the co-founders of the National Anarchist Tribal Alliance of New York. Craig, just give us a little bit about your background. I know some of our listeners have already heard the previous interview you did, but just to refresh everyone, who are you?
To keep it short, I'm Craig Fitzgerald. I've been involved in activism in New York in many different angles, and currently I'm homesteading in upstate New York, and a few years ago, me and my wife and some other people started NADA, as you said before.
Okay, and what is NADA, National Anarchist Tribal Alliance of New York? What is that?
Well, NADA was started as an alliance or a confederacy of or a confederation of individuals and possibly even groups in the future who were committed to anti-statism and decentralization, whether they called themselves anarchists or they called themselves libertarians or they called themselves sovereign citizens or secessionists or what have you, or any of the different hyphenated anarchisms, what have you. We've mostly been involved with the homestead up here and as of late in doing farming, organic farming and such.
Well, most of the listeners to this program on Countercurrents are of the nationalist persuasion, and historically there's been some degree of conflict between nationalists and anarchists. There's also overlapping in other ways, but what would you say are the reasons why nationalists might want to take an interest in a philosophy like national anarchism?
Well, I think that for nationalists in particular might be interested in national anarchism because the modes of that nationalists have been using, you know, populist, you know, statist parties, you know, political parties and the electoral system that they've been using in Europe and here in America has really gotten nationalists of any variety nowhere. And truly, nation states today no longer represent the actual nations. Most nation states today, particularly the United States, as an example, consist of multiple nations, really. And I think that nationalists need to start looking more at the decentralist model in order to see their ideas come to fruit.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about an article you recently co-wrote with Jamie O'Hara. The article is currently up on the homepage at attackthesystem.com, National Anarchist Praxis. I found this to be a very interesting article, and I want to talk about some of the ideas that you and Jamie write about in this. First of all, you talk about the different kinds of hyphens that exist within the wider anarchist community, or there's really no one anarchist community. There's a collection of a lot of different communities that claim the title anarchist. And tell us a little bit about some of your experiences with that and how you came to national anarchism.
Well, I had been interested in anarchism from a very young age. I initially got interested in it through being into punk rock and hardcore music as a kid, and I read like anarchism, a Journal of Armed Desire when I was like 13 years old, and was very interested, did some work with Food Not Bombs and the Black Cross and some squatters' rights groups here in New York City back in the mid-90s. And what really left me kind of a bad taste in my mouth about anarchist movement, like you say, there is no one movement, but there was a lot of infighting, there was a lot of people who called themselves anarchists, especially in the punk rock world, who you couldn't really take seriously as people who had a philosophy. They, you know, anarchism and anarchy were just like a word for them that meant that they didn't work and that they panhandled in the streets and stuff like that. So I kind of got disillusioned with anarchism. And then some of the more, you know, leftist traits that were seen in anarchism where, you know, they're saying that, you know, everybody has to accept some sort of universalist doctrine when it comes to race or sex or sexuality and all this very egalitarian type thinking that many anarchists ascribe to, that eventually, like, I just didn't take it seriously. And, you know, I would always pose questions, like I said on the show before, to anarchists and libertarians, you know, well, what about people who don't fit your model? What about people who are dissenting from your model of anarchism? What do you do with them? You know, shouldn't they be left to their devices and given the autonomy and sovereignty that you're asking for? And a lot of times even anarchists and libertarians would say, no, you know, particularly when it comes to the race issue and even other egalitarian social issues, they'd be like, no, you know, those people are racists. We can't have any alliances with people who want to live in a racially homogeneous community. So this hypocrisy is what it really got me away from anarchism. But then over the years, as I eventually found national anarchism, attracted me to national anarchism. Because I do agree with Ward Churchill when he says that anarchism is essentially just a type of anti-statist nationalism. And that's what really, I really saw that to ring true. Because essentially, you know, a lot of anarchists talk about, you know, no borders and things like this, which is a lot like what the globalists talk about, by the way, but, and the internationalist crowd talks about. But, you know, when they talk about no borders, I'd be like, all right, well, you mean no border, you want to eliminate the nation state's borders, but you still are talking about sovereign, autonomous communities or regions. And they'd be like, yeah. And I'd be like, well, isn't that creating more borders? And, you know, they'd look at me like I had two heads, you know, no, you just don't get what we're talking about. So I think that what really led me to national anarchism was, in many ways, was a reaction to other anarchists and other hyphenated anarchists, but also something that I saw in national anarchism as being very organic and natural, and that this is what real anarchism is. And as I say in the article, National Anarchist Praxis, me and Jamie, my wife, say that national anarchism, it seems to perpetuate the hyphenated, you know, anarchist debate, but in many ways it works as an umbrella, because it lacks this kind of universal one size fits all model for all groups.
Well, it would seem to me to be a matter of common logic that universalism and anarchism are two concepts that are fairly hard to reconcile with one another. Given that that's the case, why do you think so many anarchists subscribe to this kind of extremist model of universalism? Because it would seem to contradict so many of their other ideas. What are some of your thoughts about that?
Well, I think, you know, you've done shows on totalitarian humanism or authoritarian humanism, you know, cultural Marxism, whatever people want to call it, politically correct. I think that has been, that the left in general has stepped away from revolutionary activities and more in kind of just placating to different special interest groups and being like, you know, jumping on the cause of any special interest group that they can has been a detriment to the left, and that included that includes anarchism. Not to say that all anarchism comes from a left perspective, but I think in general that's what's done it. I mean, if you read some of the things that Bakunin and Proudhon said about banking and usury and some of the ethnic groups that take part in such activities, that would be considered very anti-Semitic and politically incorrect today by most anarchists. So I think a lot of that egalitarian universalist outlook just has to do with that, and that the whole left movement has moved away from workers' rights and things like that towards pandering to special interest groups.
Well, I have a theory of my own on that, and I think that when people join movements, they don't just shed whatever baggage they bring with them to those movements at the door. You know, everybody, when they join any kind of movement, whether it's anarchism or socialism or nationalism or anything else, the ideas that they have been inculcated with by the broader society don't just go away overnight. You know, people don't come into any movements as experts in political theory, and certainly not any kind of alternative political theory. And I think that what's happened is that in the anarchist scene and the libertarian scene, we have a lot of people that come into those scenes that have been educated in the public school system. You know, they've been indoctrinated to think a certain way by the mass media. Many of them have been inculcated with certain values by, you know, their parents or church or, you know, just broader social norms. And right now, the prevailing cultural paradigm is one that sort of reflects this universalist outlook, and I guess in its more extreme form of the kind that we find, for example, in the universities and so forth. It's a more hard left version of the same kind of idea. But this kind of universalist outlook is something that many people are inculcated with by social institutions, by the state, and by other sectors of society, and then I think they bring that into dissident political movements. On one hand, it's like they instinctively recognize that something is wrong with the broader society, but you know they don't quite know how to filter out all the information that they're getting. They're being inculcated with certain values by the system. At the same time, they see certain problems with the system, and I think a lot of them really have a hard time piecing it together, and they bring all this baggage into whatever movements they get involved with.
Yeah, I agree. I think that it's coming from multiple different sources in our society, the reasons why, like you say, from the universities to the media to, you know, people's religious affiliations, what have you. It's definitely all pervasive, and I think more and more what we've seen in America is this kind of shift towards this kind of universal thinking, no matter what your outlook is. And I think that's kind of what the National Anarchist Praxis article was about, is that, you know, to be truly anarchists, we need to look at what we're doing. And as I said before on the show, we need to put our theories into action. And anarchists, different communities are going to have different ideas and theories and models that they put into action. So therefore, a community may, you know, do something totally different than another community. One community may use a more socialist model. One community may use a more laissez-faire model. And it doesn't matter, as long as you're putting your ideas into practice. And I think that's more important than debating amongst ourselves which ideas are best. I think actually trying to make these ideas real, concrete, is the next step in all of our lives.
Well, I've known a number of people who have come into national anarchist circles and the circle around Attack the System and some other circles that have a similar philosophy. And a lot of times these are people who come from the more mainstream anarchist or libertarian milieus. And they will tell me afterwards, they'll say, you know, Keith, when I first met you, when I first met some of your associates, I was expecting you guys to be, you know, all foaming at the mouth, neo-Nazis, and, you know, with Wagner playing in the background and so forth. And what they end up telling me is that, you know, you guys really, you and your associates are some of the most open-minded and independently minded people that they have ever met in anarchist circles, in libertarian circles. And I think that the reason for that is that, you know, we do reject this universalist outlook. We don't have this one-size-fits-all model. You know, I know I've gone on forums online and participated in some a lot of different anarchist and libertarian discussion forums, and sometimes you'll see threads that have thousands of posts where they're arguing about some tidbit of anarchist theory, like syndicalism versus mutualism versus anarcho-capitalism, in such a way that has absolutely no relevance whatsoever to anything that's going on in anyone's day-to-day life and anyone's it has no impact on any real world society. You know, it's really the equivalent of monks holed up in a monastery, you know, discussing very minute bits of theology. And the one thing I like about national anarchism is its practicality. On the question of the state, there was an interesting article published recently by, well, I believe it was published on the Green Star website, which is a national revolutionary website. It was written by a fellow who writes under the name Dan Kanuckistan, who's somewhat in the third position, national revolutionary tradition. And I want to have him on the program at some point to discuss this article. But he argues that the dichotomy between statism and anti-statism in some way is a false one because, you know, because in a decentralized society, the degree that formalized systems of government might be abolished would probably vary considerably from community to community. And he was criticizing, for example, some of the people you see in groups like the Free State Project, which is a libertarian group up in New Hampshire. He says some of their more extreme members will go out and harass crossing guards because they're enforcing laws or and things like that. What are your feelings about that? Do you feel that the core idea behind national anarchism is essentially centralism versus decentralism, as opposed to a more reductionist type of anti-statism versus statism?
I think that really the bottom line is, like you said, that every community is going to be slightly different, and some communities may retain some levels of what other communities see as statism. And I don't know if it's so much that, you know, I think all these paradigms and dialectics that are being created sometimes are unnecessary. I like the article that Dan Kanukistan wrote because it seemed very pragmatic to me. And I think that being pragmatic about the way we think about anti-statism and decentralism is the way to go. And I think that national anarchism can attract people who are anarchists, as well as I think it can attract people who are recovering statists of various sorts, whether it be libertarians or populist nationalists, etc. And I think that, you know, Dan brings up some very good points, like you say, that, you know, one community may have certain institutions and may keep certain institutions that they feel are necessary while they get rid of other institutions. But I think that the debate, you know, he kind of, Dan wants to kind of throw out the anti-state versus anti-state debate. Well, I actually think that that debate itself will lead towards the solutions that really work, like he says, for real people. and not for abstract ideologies on the left or the right. But I don't totally agree with Dan. I posted the article because I wanted to hear more from Dan about it and what he thought. I thought it was very interesting. I thought it was one of the best things that actually came out of the Green Star's original materials. It's some of the best writings that I've read, and I think it brings up some good points. That being said, I am an anarchist. I do believe in that we don't need a state, but you know, what is a state? We could get into that. I mean, people could argue that any organized community is a state of some variety. It's just a micro state. So even a tribe is a state. It's just some sort of micro state. So you know, it's all about nuance and semantics, really, when it comes down to it. So I think as anti-statists and decentralists, we need to think about the points that he brings up, that, you know, there is no one-size-fits-all model, and that some communities may have more institutions that people recognize as the state or corporatist or corporate even. You know, I mean, certainly anarcho-capitalist communities would probably still have some semblance of corporations. So it all depends. And I don't want the anarchist movement or the greater decentralist movement to get bogged down in any debate or any dialectical quagmire, whether it be statists versus anti-statists, or it be national anarchists versus national revolutionaries, or, you know, or minarchists versus anarchists, etc. I think it's just going to manifest different ways. But yeah, that's pretty much about it on that.
Okay, well, we're going to have to take a brief break now. We're at the end of this segment. We'll return shortly and continue our discussion with Craig Fitzgerald of the National Anarchist Tribal Alliance of New York. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back for our second segment. We're continuing our discussion with Craig Fitzgerald. Craig is one of the co-founders of the National Anarchist Tribal Alliance of New York. Craig, in our last segment, we were talking a little bit about the article that Dan Kanuckis, Dan of Green Star, had written discussing the question of statism versus anti-statism. And he argues in that he wants to frame the debate more in terms of centralism versus decentralism. And I think on one hand, some of the points you raise in response to that are quite interesting in the sense that, well, it's not a good idea to really get bogged down into a lot of theoretical discussions about, you know, what is a state, to what degree must anything that resembles a state be abolished. On the other hand, there are those of us like you and I who are, you know, avowed anarchist philosophically and who do have a very critical view of the state. But one thing that I'm curious about is, to what degree do you think that national anarchism is capable of accommodating philosophies that theoretically are not opposed to the state, but may in many ways be in conflict with certainly the existing states that we have? Because I've spoken to a lot of people in a lot of different movements, a lot of people from the alternative right in its various manifestations, or the populist rights, and also some people from the left as well, as well as some more mainstream conservatives and libertarians, and even some liberals, who will tell me, well, Keith, I think some of your anarchist views are a little extreme, but I think you're correct that this particular state that we have now needs to go for whatever reason. given that one of the core ideas behind national anarchism is radical decentralization and community that are sovereign and self-managed, do you think that the national anarchist paradigm is open-ended enough that it can include other philosophies that are normally outside the anarchist paradigm? I was reading a book, or I was looking at a review of a book recently on world liberation movements, talking about how there's so many different kinds of movements around the world, from the, you know, the National Front in France to the Islamic conservatives to countercultural people who are going off and forming alternative communities, saying that all of these movements really aim as their common goal the resistance to the homogenizing forces of globalization. So do you think that national anarchism can accommodate communities that are rooted in philosophies outside the normal anarchist and libertarian paradigms?
Yeah, I think so. I personally think it will. NADA, for example, has definitely attracted people who you could call disillusioned libertarians, disillusioned constitutionalists, people who came out of the Patriot movement who are kind of disillusioned by that in many ways. So I think that national anarchism could definitely be that. And I think you've stated in articles that really, you know, there could be communities that had some semblance of a hierarchical system rather than an anarchy. And some groups may be, you know, and as long as it's, excuse me, as long as it's voluntary, and it's a decentralized world that's all voluntary, and we base it on those principles, and people are free to move and choose what groups they want. I mean, people could choose to live in a theocracy for all I care. I mean, in an anarchistic world, I mean, are there still going to be Amish? Yeah. The Amish basically live in a theocracy. You know, they have community elders and, you know, religious elders of the community. So it's, you know, it's going to manifest in many different ways, as I've said before. And I think national anarchism has the potential to be this greater umbrella. If it will, I'm not sure if it will, but I've seen it attract, at least here in the States, I've definitely seen it attract people who were kind of disillusioned paleo-conservatives, like I said before, disillusioned Ron Paul people, people from the sovereign citizens movement, I think will more and more will be attracted to national anarchism and have been to some extent, at least with NADA. Yeah, and I think when you talk about, you know, we talked before about nationalists and how it could be attractive to nationalists, is I think we need to define our terms, maybe redefine our terms. The state's not a nation, as I've said many, many times before. People are nations. Groups of people are nations. So if nationalists redefine their terms and think like that, then we start thinking, okay, if people, individuals and their families and their clans and tribal units and extended family units and communities are nations rather than these arbitrary monolithic things we call nations, which are states and governments, if we redefine our terms, that national anarchism and nationalists start thinking more like that. And like I said before, nationalists start thinking more like, hey, working within the system and democratic, you know, electoral politics hasn't gotten my cause anywhere. But, you know, maybe going off with some like-minded people somewhere and putting our theories into action, the praxis that we talk about, me and Jamie talk about, you know, that goes for anybody. You know, we call it national anarchist praxis, but it could be revolutionary praxis. It could be nationalist praxis. It could be anarchist praxis. Because really, anybody who's got any theories needs to put them into action. We can sit around and talk and debate, as I said before, but unless you're making it happen, unless you're seeing your ideals come to fruition, it's not really worth that much. It's just a piece of paper. It's just a word, a sound. So we need concrete examples of how it works, and I think more and more nationalists, socialists, syndicalists, people from all ends of the political spectrum will see that decentralism and national anarchism in many ways will be the model that is going to be most useful to them, because it means putting their ideas into action on a local scale, and so they get to live in the world that they want to live. Now, that doesn't mean that the whole nation or the whole nation state or the whole world is going to follow that, but at least you're manifesting your theories in your own life. And I think that's the big thing that we're trying to push people to do, is make it happen in your own life. Don't just talk about it. Don't just complain about the state and the empire and how everything's messed up. Make it right in your own life. That's the first thing that you can change. And then maybe the whole world will change if lots of people start doing this.
Well, one thing that you talk about in the article on national anarchist practice is the idea of building parallel economies and parallel institutions. And you mentioned the concept of agorism. For those listeners that aren't familiar with that, agorism is a term that was coined years ago by a fellow by the name of Samuel Edward Konkin III. He was a radical libertarian. He was around back in the 70s. He died a few years ago. What are some of your ideas, Craig, about creating parallel institutions and parallel economies and applying this theory of agorism?
Well, I think, first off, you know, agorism, I think people on the left might look at it with, kind of hesitantly and skeptically, because it was coined by a radical libertarian and things. But really, I see agorism as a kind of natural thing that all a natural activity that all anarchists, that all anti-statists, that all decentralists, that all anarchists take part in. And a lot of people take part in agorism and don't even know it. Drug dealers, for example, smugglers of any variety are taking part in agorism, just as an example, a very rudimentary agorism. But it is about creating underground and parallel economies, and I also believe systems of, you know, social welfare networks, whatever it may be. So I think it should appeal to all anarchists, and I might sound a little elitist and presumptuous to say that all anarchists need to take part in, and anti-statists need to take part in agorism. Otherwise, you're just not doing it. Because agorism, like I said before, whether your community, its agora is a controlled socialist economy, or whether your agora is a free market, laissez-faire situation, it's all about you creating something separate from the state. For in our case, you know, we're homesteading and we have a farm here, organic farm, so there's lots of products that we're producing. Produce is one, and other products that we can put up for barter, or we could put up for trade or sale. So this is what I mean, is that, this could be selling a fanzine. You know, it starts there. It starts at the smallest level, but it just means creating a market of ideas, a financial market, an economic market outside of what the state's doing. And I think that will manifest in, like I said, alternative welfare programs, social welfare programs, alternative health care programs on the local level. I think it will necessitate it, and I think that by people doing it, by people taking part in agorism, no matter how they envision it, will eventually cause the incremental destruction of the state. Because I believe that right now, so many people can't even imagine what a decentralized, anarchistic world looks like because they're so dependent on what the state gives them. And it's almost like, you know, almost like a collective infantilism that society has. But I think the more and more communities start providing for themselves and creating free markets, or agora, and whether and that free market can, like I said, could manifest in socialism. You know, a true agora can manifest many different ways. So I think the more and more that happens, and the more, you know, and it's a revolutionary thing to do because it's a way to boycott the international globalist corporations that we don't want to do business with. It's a way to get around taxation in many ways. It's a way to get the services that lots of communities want and depend on from the state. It's a way to get them and have the state not be involved. It's a way for like-minded activists to support each other by doing business with each other and publishing each other's works and such. So I think really agorism is the praxis, is putting no matter what your hyphenation of anarchism, no matter what your hyphenation of nationalism and decentralism is, agorism is the way that you will be able to see your ideas in action and put into action and realized.
Well, as long as there have been anarchist movements, organized anarchist movements since the early 19th century, the idea of creating alternative institutions that are in direct challenge to the state has been a big part of that. It goes all the way back to one of the godfathers of anarchism, Pierre Joseph Proudhon, who advocated institutions like mutual banks and so forth. What are some of the specific types of institutions that communities can form as a means of achieving greater autonomy, greater self-management for themselves? Because in your article on Praxis, you do discuss a lot of these different kinds of institutions. And what might some of them be?
Well, I mean, it could be anywhere from guilds and trade unions, and it could be, like you say, like Proudhon said, people's banks, you know, non-usurious banks. It could be barter networks. Could be currencies, whether they be script, you know, paper currencies. It could be gold and silver currencies. Like I said, social welfare and healthcare programs. Could be militias and you know, defense organizations and associations, mutual aid societies of different varieties and sorts. I think really we can all use our imaginations that it could develop into infinite institutions, educational facilities and programs, any type of association, really. I mean, I think having a true agora, once again, is really an open market or an open place for ideas and systems. And in a true agora, we will see it manifest in so many different ways. Like I said, and if your community is more based on a certain trade, or if your community is based on religious beliefs, the institutions may be based around what the institutions are going to be in the agora are going to be based around your community's values. And like we said before, you know, each community's values are going to be drastically different. So that really depends on the community.
Okay. I know that you, as you've mentioned, have been involved in homesteading projects. Tell us a little bit more about the concept of homesteading and what kind of activities homesteaders can engage in for this goal of becoming self-sufficient.
Well, homesteading is pretty much like farming, but everything else, and trying to be as self-reliant and or self-sufficient as possible. So that can include, you know, the first basic is food and food independence and trying to grow as much food as you possibly can. But also, you know, what you can do from that, you know, you can get into preserving food and you can turn, you know, things like berries into preserves and jams and, you know, maple syrup. So there's products, you know, homespun products. And I think really homesteading is kind of like a very holistic type of farming. It's not just farming for the production of food, but it's farming and creating products from what you grow. It's using the land in general. I mean, we burn wood here to heat our house. So it's, you know, doing any number of things, from building new facilities here on the farm, to you know, making fuel. And I think really we're working on these things, and we're not anywhere to the point where we want to be in terms of self-reliance or self-sufficiency, but we're a lot more self-reliant than most other Americans, and we plan on just incrementally getting more and more self-sufficient by growing more food, by you know, raising more animals, by creating what's called, you know, value-added products, like I mentioned before, like creating jams and jellies and preserving foods, pickling, and, you know, even hand-spun crafts, you know, basket weaving, blacksmithing, anything. I think it's really a holistic thing, a holistic experience, homesteading, where you're in the environment and you're using and the environment for what it's worth without raping it, and truly living like the indigenous people lived in the Americas as much as you possibly can, giving back to the land as well as taking from the land, and being part of the land, being part of your environment, and using the environment to your advantage, with your agrarian pursuits or other pursuits. Like I said, we're using the land for energy, and I think that the more and more particularly anti-statists of all varieties get interested in, like I said, agorism, and creating alternative economies and alternative institutions, I think the more that that's done and the more that people start trying to get as independent from the state as possible, the more we're going to not only see the state crumble, because the state's crumbling already, but is it going to crumble and we're going to, you know, revert back to the dark ages, or is it going to crumble and people are going to be happy to see it crumble because we're actually free to manifest our true potential as the divine entities that we are?
Okay, well, those are some great ideas. We are out of town for our second segment. We'll return shortly and continue our discussion. We'll be back in a minute here at Attack the System on Countercurrents. This is Keith Preston. I'm your host here on Attack the System on the Countercurrents Network. We're continuing our discussion with Craig Fitzgerald. We've been discussing national anarchism, agorism, homesteading, self-sufficiency, ideas of that type. One thing that you point out in your article on Praxis is the question of instant gratification. You talk a little bit about how the globalized culture's emphasis on instant gratification has in many ways spilled over even into movements that claim to be against the system, that claim to be dissident movements. Would you care to elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, really, I think the whole culture, or lack thereof, the whole anti-culture that globalism has created, particularly here in the United States, but I think in many places around the world, that it's created this culture of, like we said, instant gratification, you know, now, gimme, people aren't used to looking at things in the long term. You know, ancient peoples were very aware of long-term time cycles, and particularly when you're a farmer and, you know, doing homesteading and stuff, you need to be very aware of these cycles, you know, for the planting and such. And I think that in itself, you know, thinking like that more is going to be a good thing, and people are going to have to do it more because, like we said, the cult, this anti-culture, has created, you know, this instant gratification scenario where it's like, I need, I want, gimme, you know, now, the check's in the mail, you know, microwave dinner, you know, everything is bang, bang, fast food. All these things contribute to it. And like I said, it's almost like the universalist and egalitarian leanings of some anarchists. It's almost like the society itself, the culture itself that we live in, is what makes anarchists like that, you know. So I think it's the same thing that I say, me and Jamie say, it's rubbed off on anarchists, this instant gratification culture, and I think that's because the greater culture has become that, and I think we need to think more about, as we said, you know, creating and sustaining communities for generations, and if we want to truly beat the state and beat the system, I think the globalists, the elite, the global elite, they look at things in the long term. So we also need to look at things in the long term. They also know that the incremental process is the best way to get things done, because they know that doing stuff overnight scares people. I mean, the Fabian Society in England, those socialists, their logo was the tortoise, because it was incrementalism, slow but steady. You know, we'll enact things slower rather than fast, and eventually we'll get what we want. So I think that we need to think like that too, more and more, and not be so obsessed with getting things right away, but maybe savor working hard and, you know, feeling like we actually was successful doing something, and that may take time. You know, right here on the homestead where we live, like, everything that we're doing is pretty much a long-term effort. Everything is gradual. You know, we always say here, slow but steady, like we say in the article, the Zapatista motto, lento pero avanzo, which is basically slow but steady, because we're making headway, and as long as we keep moving forward with our vision, and it doesn't matter how fast we go, eventually we're going to get to what we want. And I think more and more, if anarchists and anti-statists and revolutionaries of all stripes and libertarians take a step back and realize that, hey, we can make things happen on a smaller scale in our own lives and slowly make change, and maybe we'll maybe we'll see what we want in the world, and we'll see the attainment of liberty and independence for people all throughout the world.
Well, it's interesting that you raised the example of the Fabians, and their brand of socialism was different from that of the Marxists. The Marxists envisioned socialism coming about in sort of an apocalyptic, violent revolution, whereas the Fabians wanted to phase socialism in an incremental way, as you say. And it appears, actually, that the Fabian model is the one that's been the more durable over time. The Fabian model was really the basis for a lot of the social democratic states that we see in the advanced countries. And while certainly those kinds of systems have their flaws and there are things we can criticize about them, they have shown themselves, I think, to be more productive and more certainly more durable and more economically efficient than the Marxist models. One thing a lot of people who have encountered the idea of national anarchism have said in a critical sense is that it sounds too romantic, in the sense of it sounds too much like we're trying to turn back the clock and go back to pre-industrial society. When we talk about self-sufficiency or living off the land or something like that, they say, well, you know, don't you guys really just want to go off and form a bunch of Amish villages and things like that? Do you see technology on one hand, or urbanization, the continued existence of large cities, as something that is compatible with the overall national anarchist vision? Or do you see a technological regression happening, or the de-urbanization of modern societies happen?
Well, I wouldn't say that as far as national anarchism goes. I think that there's national anarchists who would be more inclined towards that type of thinking of a pre-industrial society. But I also think that national anarchism can definitely be inclusive of people who anarchists who maybe aren't as extreme, don't have the type of Luddite tendencies. I personally, I'm not a primitivist. I wouldn't even call myself a Luddite. But I do think that, you know, it's coming to a tipping point with the way industrial society has been going, and that eventually we are going to see a major decline. And that I would regard myself as an agrarian separatist. I do try to stay out of the urban areas as much as I possibly can. I do think that the urban areas are in decline. I do think that the cities in general are kind of outdated, and maybe they always were. But I also believe that there's people who are going to want to live like that, and there's communities that are going to want things provided for them. So I don't think there's any one size fits all model. I personally want to live in a community with other people where we are providing things for ourselves as much as we possibly can. Whether that means food, whether that means power, etc. Whereas others might want to live in a society where they, you know, somebody else grows the food, you know, and it's very similar to today, you know, and, you know, they're totally removed from these type of things. So I think really it's up in the air with how it goes. I mean, I do think that, you know, cities are kind of outdated, and that overall, eventually, there's going to be mass migrations out of the cities. I believe that the state wants to push as many people into the cities as they possibly can. Actually, I know that as a fact. there's actual United Nations treaties that the United States has signed on to, like Agenda 21, that talk about redistributing populations and basically pushing all populations out of rural and agrarian areas into the urban zones. So I definitely believe that that is going to cause a lot of problems in the future. And I don't know if national anarchism, you could say, goes either way. I think a lot of national anarchists like the small village model, and maybe it is some romanticized, you know, Luddite, you know, primitivist type thing. But I think other national anarchists are more pragmatic in that, hey, we may exist in a world where there is more a semblance of technology. I mean, technology is a double-edged sword, to say the least. I mean, it can be very beneficial, but it can be very detrimental.
I agree with that completely. You know, on one hand, if I have to go to the hospital to have surgery, I'm certainly very grateful for modern medical technology and anesthesia and things like that. You know, on the other hand, I hate the way that everything is so overly technologized nowadays, where, you know, I mean, pretty soon, you know, I was joking with someone today, pretty soon they're going to be there's going to be a robots invented that will wipe your rear end for you after you take a dump. You know, I mean, that's really what it's coming to with the over technology. I call it technologization. But my vision of the future is, I think that there's room for everything. I think that I think there was a blog post that I reposted at the end of our statement of purpose on attackthesystem.com. It's a blog post that was referred to me from someone else, where this guy's outlining his own vision of a future society where, you know, there are city states organized on all sorts of different political models, you know, kind of like ancient Greece, you know, monarchies, aristocracies, democracies, and so forth. And then there are space colonies and sea colonies and things like that, intermixed with all of these primitivist communities and these kind of self-sufficient ecological communities, like primitivists and neo-Luddites envision. And I think there's room really for everything. What about the question of cultural preservationism? Because I know that many listeners to Countercurrent certainly come from a cultural preservationist angle. They want to preserve either their particular racial or cultural identity or some other kind of identity. Do you really see national anarchism as something that can be a type of vanguard philosophy in many ways towards cultural preservation? Because I mentioned earlier, there's a book that's out now on world liberation movements that talk about cultural preservationist movements all over the world that vary widely in terms of their specific cultural norms or geographical location or ideological values. But the one thing they have in common is that they're resisting this kind of homogenized model that's being imposed on the entire world through globalization, through Americanization, and so forth. You know, as an example of Americanization, I know when I went to Europe for the first time, one of the first things that I noticed was that you have all this very old architecture, you know, hundreds of, you know, even thousands of years old in some places. And right intermixed with all that, you have all these American fast food restaurants, you know, McDonald's, Arches, and Kentucky Fried Chicken, and that kind of thing. And clearly, you know, I began to, from seeing that, I began to really appreciate the cultural preservationist angle. But I see national anarchism and similar philosophies as something that could really be a type of unifying force for all these different kinds of cultural preservationist movements that exist all over the world, because of the non-universalism involved. You know, I think that there could, you know, that national anarchists and white nationalists have much in common. For that matter, I think national anarchists and black nationalists might have much in common, or conservative traditional Muslims might have much in common. Would you agree with that?
I wholeheartedly agree with that, really. And I think that, like I said before, when we're talking about national anarchism attracting nationalists, is, I think, the same thing for any type of cultural preservationist, is that we have cultural preservationists of any variety, whether they be black nationalists, whether they be white nationalists, whether they be Christians of whatever variety, or Muslims, whatever. What they have to realize is that the nation state in general, nation states and globalist institutions are not helping people preserve their indigenous traditions and cultures. They're actually, like you say, in many ways, Americanizing, but I don't even like to say that. That American culture of McDonald's and stuff is actually just an anti-culture. It's not even the real American culture, but that this anti-culture of the global, this global unified universalist culture or whatever, this homogeny, this global homogeny, it itself is what's holding back cultural preservationists. So if they're interested in preserving their individual unique cultures, they need to take on, like I said before, a decentralist model and more of, thinking on whether they're, I think it's a decentralist model rather than an anti-statist model, really, because like we said before, some of these groups may see some semblance of a state as necessary. Well, so be it. But is the nation state that we see today or the global governance system that we see today, is it helping these people and these groups preserve their traditions, preserve their race, preserve their cultures, preserve their spiritual traditions? I say no. So I think as nationalists, as cultural preservationists, we need to think more and more about doing it on our own, not relying on the state or any sort of policies, government policies to help or to change anything. Really, we need to do it ourselves. So if you want to preserve your culture, well, like I said before, get with other people who are on that same mindset and preserve your culture together. Live together. Start a community, where your culture is highlighted, and unless people do that, I think slowly but surely the global culture, anti-culture as I call it, will inundate everything and everywhere. Like you said, you've traveled all over Europe and the world and you've seen this anti-culture everywhere, and it is becoming all pervasive. So I think more and more that we opt out of that, no matter what our position is, whether we come from a nationalist position, a cultural preservationist position, an anarchist position, the more and more we opt out of it and do our own thing, the better off we'll be.
Okay, well, I think that's a very good point on which to end the program. Craig, thank you very much for coming back on the program. I want to have you on again at some point to discuss these ideas further. You can find more. Craig, what's the web address for National Anarchist Tribal Alliance of New York?
I believe it is NATA, NATA-NY.blogspot.com.
Okay, so to find out more about the National Anarchist Tribal Alliance of New York, just go to Craig's blog. He's got some great articles there, including the article I've been discussing this evening, the one on Praxis. That article is also available on the homepage of attackthesystem.com. Once again, Craig, thank you for being here. And until next time, this is Keith Preston for Attack the System here on Countercurrents. Have a good week.
Thanks for having me.